The Packers go to Pittsburgh and prove they're not dead yet. The Rams get back on track by lighting up the shorthanded Saints. Alex Smith goes off a cliff against Buffalo. Crabtree is throwing punches. Talib is snatching chains again. And we're talking Grey Cup, or at least one of us is, all on a jam-packed episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We are talking week 12. You know, they're all kind of wild weeks, and there's always interesting things that happen over the course of, you know, a dozen games or so. But this week especially just seemed, you know, it was bizarro. It was teams that played well ended up losing, and teams that didn't play so well ended up winning games, and hamburgers eating people, and the whole thing was it was kind of a mess in a fun way.
It was. In a really fun way, because we're going to start with that Sunday night game, which was probably the most entertaining and really one of the most well-played Sunday night games we've gotten all season long.
Number one.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think I am out on a limb by myself on this, saying I did not think this game would be competitive. But the Packers more than hung around. I mean, they were there at the end of the game if they could have put one more drive together. I guess the story in this one was Brett Hundley looking, you know, he wasn't, Collinsworth was sort of going a little bit nuts at the end with the, you know, I don't think Aaron Rodgers could have played better than Brett Hundley did in this game. But Brett Hundley, certainly impressive. The sense I got early on was that the Steelers were all kind of like licking their chops, and you know, everyone in the secondary was thinking they were going to have three interceptions, and they're probably planning end zone dances in their heads. But Packers jumped on them early, and they they held on for longer than I think you could have possibly expected here.
Well, they got the big plays, and it felt like that got Hundley comfortable. And I was extremely disappointed with the way he played last week. And I thought he looked very good in the second half of that Bears game. And then last week against the Ravens, he took a gigantic step back. And it may have even been his worst game as a pro. And I was very disheartened by that. And so we're at the stage where we don't know what Brett Hundley we're going to see, which guy is going to show up. And the Steelers, with some of their mistakes on defense and Hundley able to take advantage and his receivers making plays, he gets comfortable and we see the good Brett Hundley. What got overlooked by the announcing team tonight, and they do a great job every week, this is not a criticism of Collinsworth or Michaels, it got overlooked in the flow of the game. That first down sack on the final drive that T.J. Watt had, where he came out of eight-man coverage and blitzed, he basically green-dogged without having a guy. A green dog is where you have man-to-man and your man stays in and blocks, so you rush and become a green dog blitzer. He basically did that, but out of zone, which is unusual. It worked out for him. But Hundley had guys on the field, and that's a three-step drop back out of empty. So the ball has to be out. And he had not great throws, but he had throws available. And an experienced quarterback takes those throws. They gain 2 or 3 yards. They don't lose 6 or 8 yards or whatever it was and stall the drive. And also, Hundley broke himself down in the pocket there when he saw Watt move. His instinct was not to throw. It was to tuck the ball and move around. And that's been his problem. That's what he'll have to fight against. That's what he has not fought well against when he has struggled. So as good of a night as it was, and it was even a great night by him, in the most critical moment, he unfortunately reverted back to the bad habits that have been plaguing him so far.
He was, and you know, there was a glimpse of that in the third quarter. It was sort of getting to a point where it looked like they were going to, it reminded me of the Saints game, that first start, where he couldn't wait to just get out and run. Like, he wasn't going to pull the trigger on anything, and he was just sort of waiting for everyone to sort of clear out and create enough space that he could tuck it and take off and run, and it wasn't, it wasn't working. That's not a formula that's going to work for them. But, I mean, look, that 12-play drive in the fourth quarter was, I mean, that was stunning. I could not believe that happened.
It was a lot of defined reason, and he did a good job in the pre-snap phase at the line of scrimmage. I mean, what do you have, 8 throws on that drive? I bet at least half of them were some kind of smoke or run-pass option throw where he was basically throwing out of a running play, identifying the defense. It started with that seam pass to Rodgers against the slot blitz from the Steelers, 25 yards to get the drive going. By the way, Gary, that fourth and six timeout at the end of that drive, which ultimately probably didn't have an impact on the outcome of the game,
mm-hmm.
it very well could have, though. Mike McCarthy, who did a great job tonight, I don't know how you can call a play on fourth and six and not have anticipated a slot blitz from the Steelers based on everything Pittsburgh's done the last month of the season and with Mike Hilton and the way they play and the way they've been playing. To have to call timeout because they see a slot blitz from the Steelers, that to me, and they got the 8-yard completion right after that to Adams,
yep.
but I was baffled that they weren't prepared for that slot blitz with their initial play call.
Yeah, I don't know. I get maybe they just thought they had the Steelers back on their heels a little bit more at that point, but
when the Steelers get on their heels, the Steelers become blitzers. They're not
do.
Comfortable. That's and you remember you coach against coaches, so you're coaching against Keith Butler and his tendencies, not mm-hmm. Mike Hilton and Ryan Shazier and Cameron Hayward. You coach against coaches. Butler's a blitzer, and I was surprised McCarthy didn't anticipate that initially. Again, they worked out, and he had a lot of good play calls tonight. Tough order, though, to go into Pittsburgh with that backup quarterback and tough order to go into Pittsburgh, period. That's a great defense, and those superstars on Pittsburgh obviously did their part of the share tonight.
Those offensive superstars. Antonio Brown, the catch that set up the game-winning kick was unbelievable.
Yeah,
and
it looked like goofy officiating at first, but they were just – those
did.
Officials were reacting the same way we all reacted.
Especially
which is just
the
like,
one
wow,
guy – I don't know. I don't know which official it was. He did like the double take of the other guy when he signaled catch. Like, oh, I'm not going out there with you.
Do you think if it hadn't been Brown, they would have like assumed? Because I mean, they were guessing at that point. If it had been anyone else, do you think they would have erred on the side of incomplete? It's getting reviewed no matter what.
I don't know. I think when you could see the feet. I mean, that's got to be like the only thing you're looking at that point. And when you see the grass get kicked up, and there's no sort of like, you know, it's not the cleat on the white where you can sort of, you know, the buzzer goes off in your head and you immediately start incomplete. So,
I wonder if
there's
an answer to this. This is a Dean Blandino, Mike Pereira question, but I wonder if maybe one official's job is to watch the feet, the other guy's to watch the ball. Probably not, though, because you don't know which way the receiver's going to be facing necessarily. I don't know. They got the call right, though, to their credit. They got it right in real time.
They did. Yeah. They. So I have two Blandino Pereira, one that actually happened and one hypothetical. I was wondering a catch like that. The going to the ground on the sideline type of thing. If that was the Packers sideline, can Mike McCarthy just like punch the ball out and then it's incomplete?
That's got to be some form of interference.
I mean, once he's rolling on the side, I mean, not blatantly, but you know, can you sort of like land on Brown and be like, oh, I was just standing in front of my bench back from the chalk?
You could conveniently accidentally be in the way or something like that.
God,
that's a great question, I guess.
Till,
I don't know.
I can't
I mean, if he's
wait
punching
until that
the ball
happens.
Out, yeah, that I can't either. The closest I've ever seen is Bill Cowher almost tried to tackle a guy on a return, like a
that's
kick
right.
or an interception return. That guy was on the field.
Jaguars.
Those Steeler
– Yep.
Was that what it was? Yep, you're right. Those Steeler
the Monday
coaches
night game.
Tend
yep.
to get involved. Yeah.
They do. Tomlin, too, in the Ravens game. The thing that actually happened that I was kind of surprised there was no clarity on this, and maybe I'm misunderstanding the rules. So the Watt sack on Hundley, NBC just sort of came back and showed the replay, and Michaels and Collinsworth were kind of like, helmet to helmet, not called. My understanding is Hundley is not a passer at that point. I mean, he's not in any sort of passing stance or motion, and is therefore considered a ball carrier, a runner at that point. So I thought it was by the book. I mean, if you want to throw a flag on a guy for a violent helmet-to-helmet hit, you know, I'd never have a huge problem with it. But by the book, I thought that was clearly not a foul there.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I was glad, even take it outside the book, and let's just watch football now. And I know that's not how we officiate, and it's player safety is vital in the big picture. I was glad that wasn't flagged, though, because Hundley, that's another case. He was broken down in the pocket. He wasn't going to throw there, and it's a good thing. Watt, if Hundley had thrown, Watt would have hit him right in the belly button.
Andy, let's move on.
Number two.
This is the Saints and the Rams. This was the thing that stood out to me most in this game. We're going to start with the Rams offense. Not only was Jared Goff really sharp during this game, and look, the Saints were shorthanded in the secondary, and we've talked about how valuable Marshawn Lattimore is to that secondary. They were missing both starting corners in this game, Ken Crawley out as well. But when it came time to basically seal the win and milk the clock, they were still throwing it. I mean, McVay had full confidence in Goff to go out there and basically make throws to keep the clock going.
McVay's shown a lot of confidence in Goff lately. McGoff has done as much at the line of scrimmage in the pre-snap phase as almost any quarterback in the league. Now, what we don't know, and what I would love to ask McVay, is how much of that is coming from the radio and the headset, because they get to the line early in Los Angeles. They're kind of they're not a hurry up, but they're definitely a tempo, no huddle offense. So clearly Goff is hearing something from McVay until those 15 seconds come up where the headset then shuts off. So how much of it is McVay calling the game at the line of scrimmage, and how much of it is Goff? And do they have, I'm sure they have a lot of either or options and kill the play, and it's one or the other. There's a lot that goes on there though, but that's getting overlooked in Los Angeles, is Jared Goff, who everyone thought was looked way too young last year, is not only running a really expansive offense, but he's doing a lot of it in the pre-snap phase up at the line of scrimmage.
Yeah, I think that's putting it very, very kindly, saying people thought he looked too young last year. People thought he couldn't play last year. People thought he was like one of the Jamarcus Russell sized draft bus.
Coaching really, Gary, coaching, I was thinking about this because this might be the most stark example we've had of coaching impacting a QB. I mean, Goff was not in a great situation a year ago. That coaching staff, I think in the back of their minds, they all knew they weren't long for that world in LA, and that trickles into your job. Not saying they didn't try, but that impacts human beings, and they didn't have a great plan overall in place. Remember when you're in school, and just think of the difference. Let's say you're in a class that you don't understand really well, biology, and you're more of an English type of student. Imagine having a bad biology teacher in biology class, and then what kind of student you feel like then, and then what kind of student you felt like when you had a great English teacher in an English class. That's the difference for a quarterback when he's in the right system with the right coach. It's a whole different world. Coaching gets so overlooked in the NFL. I think next to quarterbacking, it's unequivocally the most important thing for a team.
Yeah, and look, this was also, I mean, look, the Rams won this game. That's very encouraging. But it felt like after that Vikings loss, it might be a point where, are they a little bit shaken? Is this a time of year where the wheels come off a little bit with the young team? And they certainly bounced back very nicely in this game. I mean, look, I thought the Saints might be able to essentially steamroll the Rams in this one and sort of dominate time of possession as they have during their 8-game winning streak, and that did not come to fruition at all. Actually, Rams had the ball for 35-26 in this one, so basically a 35-25 split in the Rams' favor. Not Drew Brees' sharpest game. Mark Ingram never really got going. So this was a solid performance by the Rams defense, and it's a good defense that I think that gets overlooked just because of what the offense has done this year.
Yeah, it's a fast playmaking defense, and they have not been great against the run. 128 yards a game allowed, or excuse me, 123 yards coming in, ranked 28th against the run. The Saints' ground game has really been rolling, and today the Rams dominated the Saints' ground game, and that was also a big factor.
Yeah, and just one more thing on the Saints here. Alvin Kamara is phenomenal. Alvin Kamara is like mini Le'Veon Bell with some of these plays he's making at this point.
You get a guy like that with Breeze who can adjust to him and motion him out, and they can run the full offense out of any personnel package. That's a really valuable weapon to have.
He had 11 touches and 188 yards in this game, 2 touchdowns. He had a 74-yard touchdown run, and that wasn't even his most entertaining run. I mean, he is making yardage where there is absolutely no yardage and doing it in an entertaining way. He is absolutely my favorite guy to watch in the league at this point.
Number 3.
After all that beautiful offensive football we just talked about, we're going on to Bills and Chiefs. I mean, these were two teams certainly going in the wrong direction heading into this game. And the Bills got out early, and it really didn't take many points to win in Kansas City the way the Chiefs' offense is going.
5-3 and outs to start the game for Kansas City, and Buffalo's
unreal.
Able to establish a little bit of a lead there. I can't remember seeing an offense that was so great for the first six games, or five games really in their case, and then has been so bad for the next following six games. Here's what's happened with Kansas City. There is a blueprint, and I'm not a big blueprint guy. I don't believe in that. I don't think that's how it works. But in this case, when the Steelers came out on October 15th, back in week six it was, because the Chiefs were 5-0 going into that game, the Steelers played that soft zone coverage. They kept everything in front of them. That became the blueprint for facing the Chiefs, because all that misdirection stuff, all the gadgetry, Tariq Hill running around, Travis Kelce going the other way, that stuff really stresses matchup coverages, because you manipulate the defenders. They follow the guys who are running the misdirection, and now you're creating the angles and leverage, and you're forcing the defense to play into your hand. Well, if the defense just backs off and plays zone, then the misdirections, it's not all wasted energy, but it's mostly wasted energy. And if you get cornerback who can secure the edge, which is what we've seen. The Giants did it the week before. Dallas was phenomenal with it with their corners. Buffalo today, you take away the Tyreek Hill to the edge factor, or at least you limit that, and now mm-hmm. the field's not so wide, and Alex Smith is playing on a narrow field where arm strength becomes a little bit of an issue. He's not an anticipation passer. He's got more throws to make with less area to make them. Everything becomes a whole different game. It all comes from playing zone defense and keeping Kansas City's misdirection stuff in front of you. So the Chiefs, their response, they've got to start beating zone coverage, and I think the way you do that is to go downfield. You attack teams, make them scared to play zone. Get Travis Kelce, Tyreek Hill inside on the formation, run them on some vertical routes, attack the safeties, get coordinators hesitant to just line up in zone and play against you.
Yeah, I mean, look, the play that I had emailed you about during this game, and really a lot of people were talking about, was at the end of the first half, that that Travis Kelce over route that Smith didn't see it. It was a 3rd and 6, I believe, and he ended up throwing short to the sticks to Albert Wilson. It was incomplete, but he had a touchdown there if he makes the anticipation throw to Kelce.
And see, Smith is not an anticipation thrower. He's a see-it-then-throw-it guy. And the problem with that, and why I think he's always been a very average quarterback, and an average one who can still run a full system. So when he's well-coached and he's in a good scheme with weapons, like we've seen for much of this year, he's still effective. But when it's not working, he becomes very average, because not only is he not anticipatory, but he doesn't have great arm strength. And if you're a see-it guy, you need to have a cannon to make up for that, because you're throwing a little bit later every time. So he's a see it guy, not an anticipation guy. Plus, he has just an okay arm. In fact, probably a below average arm by NFL standards. So those type of throws, that over route, the pocket was collapsing just enough around him that he didn't have a whole lot of space to throw from. That's another thing. He needs a lot of space to get that arm strength to give him any chance at all. He doesn't even think about throws like that, because he's never really been capable of making them. You don't think about doing stuff that you're not physically capable of doing. It's never occurred to you.
And certainly, you know, give a little bit of credit to the Bills defense here. I mean, I won't run through all the stats from their previous two games, but they'd allowed 60 first downs over the previous two games, and the Chiefs didn't get their first down until the last 4 minutes of the first half in this one. They are held to 10 points, 236 yards, so a nice bounce back day for a Bills defense that quite frankly had been humiliated in the previous two games. So nice work by them. And look, Tyrod Taylor, you know, no one's gonna say Tyrod Taylor won this game, but this was the kind of game that Tyrod Taylor could win. I mean, they got a lead, and Taylor's not a guy who's gonna make a big glaring mistake and turn the ball over and flip the game on you. I mean, this was a game that the Bills can win.
Yeah, I didn't think Taylor was outstanding, but he played fine within the context of what they needed him to do and what he can do. So like what you said, he used his legs effectively. He was judicious in doing it and effective when he did it.
Number 4.
Some more questionable quarterback play. We're going Cardinals-Jaguars. The one nice thing about this game is how many times have we talked on this podcast over the last two seasons about the Cardinals losing a game on sort of some sort of heartbreaking special teams mishap? And, you know, this past offseason, they go out and they get Phil Dawson, who is 70-something years old, to be their kicker because he's reliable and he's going to bring some stability to the kick game. He's having the worst season of his career. And what happens in this one? They line up and get a 57-yarder at the end of the game to win it, to beat the Jaguars at home 27-24. I guess we'll start with the... the Jaguars side of it, and this was another game where they played from behind, which is not what they want to do, and yet they made it work because their defense got a touchdown, they got a long kickoff return, and then they just got Bortles making some plays with his legs, but boy, if the Cardinals had just made them go 65, 70, 80 yards on some of these drives, it's like there's no way the Jaguars were scoring multiple times in the second half.
No, of course not. But that's the formula for Jacksonville. This is how they're going to have to win games. And their defense, statistically, when you look at it, I mean, it's up there with some of the great defenses of all time if they keep doing what they're doing, especially when you add in the scoring themselves, the defensive playmaking that we've seen. That's the formula, because we could sit here for five more minutes, Gary, and just rip on Blake Bortles talking about him, but Blake Bortles is what he is, and they know that, and you have to play around him. They'll make a change at quarterback after this season. They'll try to figure something out. In the meantime, they've got a good, solid rookie running back. They have decent special teams, and they have maybe the best defense in the NFL. That's their formula, and you play around him with that. And that's possible. It's not easy, but it's possible. It didn't work out today, but this is how Jacksonville, they're gonna have to win ugly like this, just like they lost kind of ugly.
Yeah, this was a tie game with less than 4 minutes to go, and Gabbert and Bortles within a minute of each other through interceptions, and it was just kind of a fitting way to see this one, how it played out. Oh, it's also some questionable clock management by the Jaguars. They were in a 2nd and 8 at their own 12 with 37 seconds left. They had run it on first down and gotten 2 yards, and it looked like they were just going to run it out, and they do that thing that teams do where it's kind of like go for it or don't go for it. But don't play it so in between. And they decide to throw in 2nd down. Short pass, Marquise Lee drops it. So, I guess you can't completely put it on Bortles, but I don't know what they expected there. But that, you know, Cardinals have one timeout left at that point. That left just enough time for the Cardinals to get the ball back on the punt. Two plays set up the field goal, and that's how they won it. So
that's the same thing that happened in the Steelers game. That Jamal Williams steps out of bounds on 2nd down after the TJ Watt sack. That's the same as the incompletion. So we've seen two teams now, kind of Bruce Arians related teams today, winning on bad clock management with a team late in a tied game.
I will say that the Williams stepping out of bounds at least didn't, it was a bad idea, but it didn't directly affect it because the Steelers end up not needing both timeouts. But, the Cardinals end up needing every second they could get in this one.
Keep in mind, though, Gary, when you've got those two timeouts, you call your plays differently.
That's a good point.
Route combinations are different, and Brown gets open. I mean, you know, all that still helps. It still matters.
You're right. That is actually a very good point, Andy. Because we don't live in box scores. Lastly on this game, though, of course, winning quarterback Blaine Gabbert. And this was a revenge game. He got his revenge, his long-awaited revenge on the Jacksonville Jaguars for...
Is that how that works?
For employing him for 3 seasons. finally took it out on them. And, Liam Neeson is going to star in the movie, and it'll be fantastic.
You know what I like about Blaine Gabbert? I've never met him in person. I met him over the phone once when he was coming out of Missouri. I interviewed him over the phone. Mm-hmm. And I asked him why. I mean, in so many words, I'm going to paraphrase everybody here, but I said, why are you coming out? And he basically said, because this is my chance to make money, and it's not worth the risk of not making money if you get hurt as a senior. And I admired the hell out of him for saying that, for just being so upfront about it. Because that was back before guys were getting hurt in bowl games, and it was kind of a little bit, you didn't say that kind of thing back then. It was a faux pas almost. And he just said, yeah, well, you got to make your money when you can make your money. And he did.
I was kind of, I like the logic and practicality of a quarterback saying that.
So it's like when Steve Nash said when he was way washed up and still playing for the Lakers, he had a $10 million contract, I think it was, and he said on a podcast, I'm coming back for the money. I love Steve Nash forever after that.
There you go. You only get so long, and then, like, what are you going to make money doing? I think people kind of don't realize professional athletes sometimes don't have a ton of skills outside of the athlete part, and then they live for another 40 years.
Not skills that'll pay them. Right. If you have great skills in this world, you can get an $80,000 a year job, and that's very nice and respectable. You can't get a $10 million a year job or even a $2 million a year job with just a good skill set. So these athletes don't have the kind of skills to be millionaires every single year coming out. That's very true.
There you go. Andy, before we move on, Thanksgiving has passed and we've officially entered the holiday season. And really, there's no better time of year to remind the people most important in your life just what they mean to you. And I really can't think of a better way to do it than with a bouquet or a festive plant from Pro Flowers. It's not a traditional gift, but it says so much more. Pro Flowers' best-selling candy cane roses are a great option for a holiday gift, December birthday, anniversary, or really just any occasion. Or you can always go with their classic mini Christmas tree that comes with lights and ornaments. No matter what you choose, our listeners will get 20% off any Pro Flowers bouquet or plant of $29 or more. Pro Flowers bouquets and plants are guaranteed to stay fresh, and you control the delivery date. Pro Flowers gives you more bloom for your buck. Big, beautiful flowers, more stems for your money, and long-lasting freshness. To get 20% off all bouquets of $29 or more this holiday season, go to proflowers.com and use our code THINGS at checkout. That's proflowers.com and code THINGS.
Number five.
All right, Andy, topic number five, we are going Broncos Raiders. And I guess first we'll talk about two guys who probably won't be sending Pro Flowers orders to each other. Michael Crabtree and Aqib Talib go at it again, and with the chain again. It's with the Talib's got to stop taking his chain, or Crabtree's got to get a nice jewelry box and just keep the chain in there from now on when these teams play.
Yeah, or these two jackasses need to just grow up and be professional athletes. One of those three options would work out better for them than the option they chose today.
Did you see the previous play? So tonight, the buzz was on the previous play, Crabtree had thrown a little uppercut at Chris Harris. Chris Harris took exception to it. I can't get too fired up about it. I don't know how egregious it was. It was a little something extra on a block that Crabtree threw, but I don't know if I consider it a punch. Did you see the play?
I saw Chris Harris's reaction to it.
Yeah.
I didn't see what Crabtree did to him, though.
Yeah, it was like a little uppercut, kind of like a boxing match when the two guys are tangled to get them separated. Someone throws a little uppercut or something like that. I don't really know that much about boxing, but hopefully you can visualize that. Yeah, it got ugly real quick, and I don't know. I guess this was completely expected considering what happened last December.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of premeditated. It comes in early in the game and it happens. And, you know, look, remember once Walter Ayoos Jr., the great photographer of SI, when he retired, he wrote a story for the magazine, just like kind of his career and things. And the line that always stuck with me, he said it very casual in there. He said, all the guys that you've heard are assholes when you meet. He goes, Randy Moss, Barry Bonds, and he kind of hung guys out to dry.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, the guys that you hear are assholes. Who are the guys always fight? It's always Michael Crabtree in something. Everybody's getting mad at him for something. It's Aqib Talib, fisticuffs every few months with him. I mean, this is, you know, sometimes these guys just are what they are, and it's not a great thing. It hurt both of their teams today. The Raiders were without their top two receivers. Cooper went out with a head injury.
Mm-hmm.
Crabtree, of course, got himself tossed. And then the Broncos, Brendan Langley, the backup corner who came in for Talib, he got killed. And you could say he was the reason Denver lost the game. Oakland went after him in the red zone. They went after him on the cover zero blitz to seal the win at the two-minute mark with Cordarrelle Patterson on a 50-something yard gain. So Aqib Talib gets in a fight, gets out, his backup gets him beaten, and their season's basically securely over now. And here we are sitting around talking about Michael Crabtree acting like a juvenile punk again. I mean, I don't know what else there is to say. It's the same suspects every time with these guys.
Yeah, and I will say I was watching this game when Brendan Langley got beat, I think it was by Cooper, before he had the concussion on the touchdown. And I was like, why is Brendan Langley even in the game? I'm like, oh, right, that thing.
Yep.
I will say this. I'll say one thing about the guys who are assholes. It seems like there's a certain point, weirdly enough, where the guys who are such complete assholes – actually, you know, everyone off the field will be like, actually, they're really nice guys. They're just, they rise to this, you know, it's like how cold water boils faster, which I don't know if that's actually true, but that was always the old wives' tale. Like they just rise and just, they go too high on the asshole scale because they just started too low before they took the field, but...
And by the way, since we're on the topic of kind of like hot-headed assholes, and I'm not going to, you know, Marshawn Lynch, is he like the self-appointed sheriff of all the hot-headed cornerbacks in the NFL? Because he felt it was his duty to escort Tlaib to the locker room. Eventually, a staffer came in and separated him, and Lynch tried to say, you know, no, I'm Marshawn Lynch, and I understand guys like Aqib Tlaib. I'm going to walk into the locker room, and the guy said, get the hell out of here. You're on the other team. Just like Lynch got himself suspended for going out there to run to Marcus Peters' side. I don't know why Lynch feels that he's the mentor of all the immature cornerbacks in the NFL.
I mean, well, he was literally the mentor of Marcus Peters because they knew each other from Oakland back in the day. But
fair.
Yeah,
okay, that's an answer for that one. What's the Tlaib answer then?
It's just because Marshawn Lynch is like, I don't even know, this sort of like farewell season or whatever he's doing, which is, I mean, it's neat to have him back. And I think it's there's something, I guess, kind of adorable about it that he's just like, taking it upon himself to be some sort of, I don't know, crossing the aisle sort of peacekeeper, universal
right,
peacekeeper among
the
all
NFL
players
now.
Here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you ought to go over to Michael Crabtree. Lynch played really well today, by the way. They got him the ball. I didn't realize, they said on the game, he's averaging 9 carries a game coming in. I've watched every snap of Raiders film, and I've thought Lynch has looked pretty good overall this year. The production has not been there, but he's a volume runner, and to have him getting 9 carries, that's fair criticism of Todd Downing, their new play caller. You have to give him the ball more. If you're going to have Marshawn Lynch and you're going to play that brand of football and you've got that offensive line, that road grading north and south run game, that's too many pieces that fit well together for Lynch to be getting 9 carries a game. And they made a very concerted effort. It was immediately apparent they were going to feed Lynch the ball, and it worked out well. And his numbers, you know, I'm sure his yards per carry were about 3.5 or something this game. It was the volume and the sustainability you get from it, and then what that does for the rest of your offense. And that's not a team built to win on third down and long. They do chip blocks, and they do quick strike throws. They don't have an offensive line that they want playing in third and long, so Lynch becomes even more important for them.
Yep. And in Todd Downing's defense here, just keep in mind that 9 carries per game was affected by the fact they only had 2 in that Chiefs game when he got tossed for being the universal peacekeeper of the NFL.
Very good. It all comes full circle.
There you go. Look, the other story coming into this one was Paxton Lynch getting thrown back in there because the Broncos just don't have a quarterback, and why not try everyone at this point? And it looks like it's going to be back to the drawing board next year. I mean, what do they do at this point?
Well, I'm confused because he hurt his ankle on what appeared to be a non-contact injury, and then he sat on the bench crying. And so, in fact, I was supposed to write about Paxton Lynch for the extra point. I called Peter King and said, hey, you still want me to do this? You want to go somewhere else now? Because we don't know. It looked to me like, well, he must have blown out his Achilles or something. But the reports I've heard is that he was in a walking boot, but he hopes to play again soon, which leads me to wonder, why was he crying on the bench then? What information did he have at the time? I don't know what's going on with that quarterback situation in Denver. My guess is when the dust settles on this season, John Elway is going to look and realize, hey, we're in the same scenario we were 3 or 4 years ago. We've got a great defense. It's talented. It's still young and has stars at some of the right places. let's not mess around and waste the years with this defense. Let's go find a QB, and I'm going to call the New York Giants and see if they want to give me another Manning.
Yeah. No, that makes sense, and we'll see if the Giants will do that. I threw out Case Keenum based on absolutely nothing this morning because it seems like the Vikings are sort of just raring to move on to Teddy Bridgewater any day now.
Well, we'll see about that. I mean, that's they've got a lot of there's a lot to go for the rest of this season, and Case Keenum's playing extremely well, and it's nice to they love Bridgewater there. Let's just pump the brakes on that though, and what they're doing. Let's not forget what Bridgewater is. Not a big difference between Bridgewater and Keenum stylistically.
I agree, but clearly the body language out. They are so eager to go back to Bridgewater. I mean, it's a week to week thing.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, when 2018 rolls around, when next summer rolls around, I don't even know if it's a competition. Anything short of Case Keenum winning a Super Bowl, which is within the realm of possibility, it's not a better than 50-50 chance or anything, but it's certainly a possibility. I think they're going to move on no matter what, and Bridgewater's their guy.
I don't think Elway would go get a QB that's any sort of a question mark. And to John Elway, I know some people, our listeners, they might say, well, Eli Manning slowing down, that's a question mark. That's not how John Elway would view that in that scenario. Yeah. Elway knows what professional quarterbacking is, and he knows Case Keenum's 6'2". He doesn't have a big arm. He's having a great season. He's getting well-coached in Minnesota. They have a great system. He's running it very well. But he's not a guy we're building our system around, and that's what we need. We need someone to build around because we have no identity whatsoever on offense, and that's what Elway's going to evaluate. And if it's not Manning, it's Drew Brees, it's maybe Kirk Cousins, maybe I bet it's not even that. It's got to be a meter moving quarterback if Elway's going to make a change after this season.
I think Super Bowl 52 MVP Case Keenum ends up being the answer out in Denver. Paxton Lynch,
really?
By the way.
You want to bet 1 year's salary on it? And we're assuming Lynch is going to be done. Lynch has played, what, 2.5 games as a starter? So maybe we ought to just pump the brakes ourselves here. The problem, the hard part is Elway knows he's got a dominant defense still, potentially.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been up and down this year, but when they play well, they're as good as anyone in the NFL. It's going to be hard to roll the dice. And even if Lynch plays great for the next, let's say he plays the last four games, he lights the world on fire, it's still a roll of the dice to go into the next season with him, and I don't think Elway's going to want to. His history says Elway's not going to roll the dice. He's going to make a bold move and try to capitalize on that defensive talent again.
And that's that's my problem with Lynch. That's why Lynch is right to cry at this point. I mean, what was the plan? What did they think was going to happen here? They gathered up, whatever. They got Mark Sanchez and they got Trevor Siemian. When they took Lynch, I mean, the consensus was Lynch was a multi-year project and he wasn't going to get on the field. He definitely wasn't going to get on in 2016. And 2017 was sort of a question mark with him. So I don't know.
No, I hear you. Because the narrative is they're blowing this quarterback and they don't know what they're doing. If a mistake has been made in their quarterback management, it was made when they drafted Lynch because they drafted a project with a team that really doesn't have time to sit around and wait on a project. So, yep. And look, if that's the problem, all right, you missed on a draft pick. You made a dumb move and that happens. You overcome it. Getting Osweiler, getting Siemian, you're doing the best you can at that point. The part that gets overlooked in all of this, nobody talks about him anymore. He won a Super Bowl. Gary Kubiak. They had Gary Kubiak when they made all these decisions. And he runs a very unique system. He's a great quarterback teacher. There was a continuity. Elway and Kubiak have known each other for their whole lives almost, their professional lives certainly. And all of a sudden, Gary Kubiak's ripped out of the equation. That's got to be unpredicted. I don't think they had a plan in place for that, if I had to guess. That just gets, nobody talks about Gary Kubiak anymore. They lost a Super Bowl winning offensive-minded head coach and are trying to figure out what to do in the meantime.
That's fair enough. But three offensive coordinators and three quarterbacks coaches for Paxton Lynch is no way to go for him.
Number six.
Titans and Colts. We're going to talk about Titans. I feel like we really haven't talked about them enough this year, considering they are... they're in the driver's seat to win the AFC South. They're probably 80% chance to make the playoffs at this point, either winning the division or winning the wild card here. And they just haven't played that well. And it's kind of nice for them that they're sitting at the 7-4 this year at this point. So my question is, what have you seen from this offense from the perspective of, I think we can all kind of accept that Marcus Mariota, everyone wanted him to make this big leap this year and be the kind of quarterback who can carry an offense. He's not ready for it. And this offense, and Mariota himself is completely different, depending on what the ground game is doing. And you saw it in this game today. They got nothing on the ground in the first half. I think they had 11 carries for 9 yards in the first half in Indianapolis. And then it all broke out in the second half, and they ended up going something like 85 yards in the second half. And Mariota works off that a little bit, and that's when they come back and they win this game.
Yeah, they're built to be a ground team. They were tremendous in two-minute situations last year where Mariota ran the hurry-up out of spread sets. They were the best in the league in two-minute offense, in fact. That got overlooked. But that's not what they want to be. They want to be that two-tight-end, two-back, smash-mouth, or what is Mike Mularkey called? Exotic smash-mouth football?
Exotic smash-mouth.
That's what they want to be. A lot of gap scheme stuff, a lot of different formations, some misdirection that naturally comes off of it, and they want to pound the rock and beat you over the course of four quarters, which means Marcus Mariota, he's a complimentary player. He's not the guy you're building around. A lot of guys have been inconsistent for that to work. You get DeMarco Murray, he's left some yards on the field the last few weeks. That's been an issue at times in his career. Derrick Henry, he's turning out to be what he was coming out of Alabama, which is someone who really needs his blocking to work. If Henry has initially a clean run, if his first 2 or 3 yards are well blocked, he's very explosive. But if it's messy and he's got some trash to work through, he's not very good. And inherently, you're probably going to have an inconsistent runner if that's the case, because you're going to have messy and trash on some of the runs. That's just what happens in the NFL. So they're trying to get their run game figured out. They know that's how they want to play. Their passing game comes off of their running game. They're not very fast at wide receiver, but they can beat you downfield with play action shot plays. All of that relates to your running game when you get down to what are we foundationally. And maybe they figure it out by late in the season. So far they haven't, but hey, as you said, what are they, 7-4 right now? That's not a bad record to have for a team that hasn't figured it out yet.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're almost definitely going to the postseason here, and we'll see what they do when they get there. And look, Colts are playing hard and sticking around in games when they don't have the roster, and it's kind of a shame that Chuck Pagano is probably not going to be there next year.
We've been saying that for like 4 years now. We've been saying that since they stopped going to the AFC Championship, or even after the AFC Championship game, I think some people were saying that.
Seems
remember,
like
Chuck Pagano hasn't had his quarterback this year.
Well, yeah, I know.
His quarterback this year.
You don't have to tell me.
Number 7.
We're going Panthers and Jets here. This was a game. This is a game that the Jets should have won. I mean, the Jets sort of beat themselves in this game, which is considering what we thought of the Jets a couple months ago. It's not a terrible thing to be saying about them. They should have beaten the Panthers at home. They were the better team in this game. I'll start with the Panthers real quick and just mention Cam Newton was not good throwing the ball today. This was bad Cam. He was all over the place. They couldn't get anything going consistently. They end up getting a couple of big plays. Really what turned this game was they got a punt return late, and they also got a strip sack and a scoop and score from Luke Kuechly to take the lead, and then the Jets just dumb unforced penalty after dumb unforced penalty, and that's how it went. But I do want to talk real quick about the Josh McCown, Robbie Anderson connection, which is something that in August I thought we'd never talk about or even want to talk about, and it's just been really impressive what they're doing offensively. It's like McCown is kind of playing like he has nothing to lose and just, you know, putting balls out there, and Anderson sometimes he gets behind the defense. He made an insane sort of strong hand contested catch today in the back of the end zone. It's a really nice thing to see.
Anderson's gotten a lot better. He's a meticulous runner. Quickness and some body control in what he does. He's pretty swift. He's had success on fade routes, especially in the red zone, which is where you tend to run your fade routes anyway. He's a good, solid wide receiver. He's not a number one, and he gets treated that way, and they build around him a little bit at times. They have to. But in the right system, he could be a 1,000-yard receiver for someone. And he might wind up finishing with that this year, too. He's been quite productive.
I was going to say, I think he's going to get there this year. Sitting at 714.
What does he have right now?
714.
How much?
714 and seven touchdowns through 11 games. So he'll not definitely, but he'll probably get there at this point. This is 6 for 146 and the 2 scores in this game. One more note from this game. Austin Seferian Jenkins, another controversial overturn of a touchdown catch. Probably the right call. It was a tough overturn, though. Blandino was actually on the screen and said he would have let it stand. And they came back and said it was overturned. And Seferian Jenkins also dropped a really bad wide-open touchdown early in this game, which was apparently his first drop of the season. So that kind of day for the Jets.
I would be surprised about that. He had a great Week 7 game against New England. I think it was Week 7. And we thought, oh, here he comes. He's breaking out. The Jets just – remember how the Ravens couldn't find a receiver, a wide receiver, for like that 7-year stretch in the early and mid-2000s? That's how the Jets have been at tight end. And Seferian Jenkins, he has not shown up on film the last month and a half of the season. I mean, forget he's even out there. They don't have a tight end in that system.
They don't. They tried Jason Morrow, and I feel that was the only realistic investment they made in the position since like the Anthony Becht days or something like that. But
Morrow, the second-round pick, and he flamed out.
Yep. Yeah.
Number 8.
Falcons and Bucks. Falcons getting back on track a little bit more here. This was Julio Jones' sort of coming-out party. If you forgot, Julio Jones is very good at football, or for some reason question that because you play fantasy and you saw he wasn't putting up big point totals. This was just kind of a reminder that Julio Jones is very good and can do a lot of things when he gets the chance.
That's some outstanding analysis there, Gary.
I was going to say, I
concur with it.
I'd been saying all season, especially the last month or so, the Falcons are so close on some of these big plays, and you know, the Panthers game still stands out to me as a game that they probably should have won. I feel like I'm really bashing the Panthers on this show, but I thought the Falcons, you know, Julio had the one drop in the end zone. He had another one that was just outside of his reach in the first quarter of that game. And it seems like the Falcons have just been just a little bit out of sync all season. And this was a game where they caught a couple of breaks here. Mohamed Sanu actually had the long touchdown pass to Julio, 51 yards on a play where, they ran a little, sort of a jet sweep action, and Sanu bobbled the ball and then gathered it and sort of dropped the perfect 50-yard pass.
Yeah, they're coming, and that's not going to be the foundation of their offense, obviously, but they're coming along. They're coming along in Atlanta. I think they are. They've been saying, we're close. I think they are getting closer. Tampa Bay has been an enormous disappointment this season, and if ever there was a reminder that the pass rush is vital when you're a zone defense, this is it. Because last season, that defense in the last 8 games was as good as almost any unit in the NFL. They just came alive, and Noah Spence was giving them some pressure off the edge. Gerald McCoy, who has had another excellent season this year, he was a part of a good pass rush last year. Now he's all there is in the pass rush, and he in of himself is not enough. So it's been a hard year for the Bucks, an underwhelming year, and it's hard to imagine that this is the same defense pretty much personnel wise top to bottom that we saw last season that got hot in the second half of the season. They're not close this year.
Yeah. Who was the last Hard Knocks team that was good? Nobody wants to do the Hard Knocks.
See, I stopped
stuff like this.
I stopped watching Hard Knocks when I found out how highly edited it was. And so I haven't kept track of even who the Hard Knocks teams are very carefully.
I never watch it because we're the one household in America that does not get HBO. So,
no, I don't get HBO, not anymore.
So how do you watch?
I did
how
as
do you ever
a kid.
Watch it?
I used to love Hard Knocks so much that I would order HBO just for the summer. You can get it by the month, I guess. But
there you go.
As a kid, I had HBO. I had HBO growing up as a kid. Channel 14 at our house. We weren't paying for it. We just had it by a mistake by the cable company. and my mother, who lives by a rock-solid foundation of core values, which can drive me nuts at times, and here you're going to understand why in a second, she called the cable company and told them that we were getting it for free because she didn't think it was right that we were getting free cable off of. It was just the one channel, too. It was just that one channel. So that was humiliating for one, and for two, it my hours of 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. became very open then, because when you're 9 or 10 years old, you're watching HBO at those hours if you've got that channel. Maybe 12 to 14 years old, let's put it on that year.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's my relationship with HBO.
That's brutal.
They didn't have Hard Knocks back then. That would have been really brutal. We used to sit around the first year they had it, Dallas Cowboys, I think they were it. May have been Baltimore. We watched in the Dallas year when Dave Campo was the head coach. The four of us, my sister, my mom, my dad, and we'd sit around and watch as a family. And Bruce Coslett was their offensive coordinator. He would drop F-bombs on this family viewing for us, and my parents found it hilarious. They loved it. So we must have had HBO at that time. I don't know how we got it back, but that would have been 2001. I would have been in my mid-teens, which means it was in my late 9, 10 years old area when I was watching at 2 a.m.
I was going to say, that explains why you said asshole so many times on this podcast today.
I'm just quoting our own photographer there. That's an SI magazine quote, if anyone has an issue. And I don't think they have to – we're not going to bleep that, are we? I mean, that's
– I don't think so, but do we lose our clean lyrics on that if we do it once? I feel like you could do it once. I feel like some shows just drop them in once and they still keep the clean lyrics designation.
Sometimes they bleep only the whole part of that word. Not the whole word, the half the word. They keep the ass, they bleep the whole.
So you could be saying like asphalt. Something like that.
Yeah, right. Yes. Yes, it could be a number of things.
And I will say, I don't want to incriminate anyone, but I knew some people who had a pirate box with all the pay-per-view channels when I was growing up.
Awesome.
And some of the channels that 12 to 14-year-olds shouldn't watch, but...
Yep, the best.
Maybe watch.
Yes, they do.
Those people might have lived in the same house as me. And
really? So are those people you? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I didn't set up the pirate box. I was too young.
Oh, you had a lot of brothers, though.
I just reaped the benefits of it. It could have been anyone.
Yeah, you had a lot of...
But it wasn't me.
All right.
Number nine.
Topic number nine, Andy. The lightning round. We're going to start with the Patriots. Patriots relegated to the lightning round for a second straight week. They beat up on the Dolphins. Not particularly surprising here. Matt Moore under center for Jay Cutler. This was actually a pretty sloppy game. A lot of turnovers. There was a scoop and score for the Dolphins where Brady wasn't expecting the snap and it came through and I guess that made it a little bit interesting. But
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know if there was anything in this game that you'd see and think that was not expected.
I bet you there's been no coach in the NFL more frustrated with his own team and the way of the season, just the difficulty of the season, than Adam Gase in Miami. He feels he matches up well to the Patriots. I think he likes playing against them. Not saying he at all thinks he can beat them. I think he likes the challenge. I think he does believe he can beat them, but he knows it's a challenge. And to come out and really not be competitive again offensively, and even though it's Matt Moore in there, that's not going to make a difference. He's having a tough year. He's not enjoying this season, I guarantee you.
Well, they started with a 3-and-out, and then the Patriots converted a fake punt right off of that, and then sort of the wheels came off immediately. So... That's the way that one went. Eagles and Bears, another game that was expected to be a blowout, and was. So these were kind of the predictable games in the lightning round. This was a 31-3. Carson Wentz, three more touchdown passes in the first quarter of a game. And, the Bears aren't going to come back on anyone when Dontrell Inman is their number one receiver.
Yeah, that's a tough situation. They don't have anyone to throw to, and – people, I know some Bears fans, and they're always saying, "Hey, what's the deal with Mitchell Trubisky? Why aren't we helping him out? Well, what's up with the play calling?" Everybody always goes to the play calling when a quarterback's not playing well, a young QB. How do you call plays if you don't have anyone for a quarterback to throw to? I mean, they just don't have guys that can get open. It's hard to operate that way. We're seeing Eli Manning struggle with that with the Giants. Imagine Mitchell Trubisky, who played all of 13 games in college, now comes into the NFL. He's got no one to throw to, and it's hard to deal with, and they've done a decent job at times. Obviously, today was not one of those days, though.
Yeah, and look, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I think it's going to be really interesting what happens with the wide receiver and tight end market in free agency this year, because it was really soft last offseason, but I think some teams are sort of paying the price for not getting the right weaponry. And on top of that, draft is not good for receivers and tight ends, as it has been. And tight ends were real good last year. Receivers were pretty good last year, too, but not a reputation as a great class coming up here. Seahawks and 49ers. This was Seahawks kind of cruising in this one. I guess the real excitement for 49ers fans was Jimmy Garoppolo got on the field, because CJ Beathard took another big hit, and Garoppolo at the buzzer beat the buzzer to Lewis Murphy to pulled it within 11, which didn't even cover the spread, so it was completely meaningless to everyone everywhere.
I think it might be time. It's not for me to call, and I respect and I appreciate that they're being patient with this and taking the long view. It might be time to get this Garoppolo thing going, though, in San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they'll have to franchise tag him regardless at this point, right?
And surely I don't think they would have made that trade unless they had plans to, and if they... Yeah. If they did make the trade saying, well, maybe we'll keep him, maybe we won't, then it's inexcusable that he hasn't been on the field yet. Because if that's the case, you got to start. He's got to play then. You've got to know what you're working with if you have a big decision to make. And they do, you know, if it's a decision. My guess is they feel they're going to franchise him all along. But if it's a big decision to make, then he needs to be out there.
Yeah. I mean, look, the one thing about potentially debuting him in this game was the Seahawks, you know, not surprisingly, dominated the 49ers up front. Beathard took another beating, so maybe you don't want to throw Garoppolo and his beautiful face behind that offensive line to take that kind of beating. But final game, Bengals and Browns. And this one will warm your heart, Andy, because the Bengals finally ran the ball effectively. And I don't know if that's something to be happy for the Bengals or be sad for the Browns, but we'll be happy for the Bengals. They end up going 30 attempts, 152. Only a second time this year they've crossed the 100-yard mark. Only second time this year they've crossed the 4 yards per carry mark in a game. Yeah. They were 5.1. It was up there. So good for the Bengals. Joe Mixon, 114.
I love Joe Mixon's game. I think he's going to be a top five running back by this time next season for sure. I mean, I think there's no doubt in my mind. Cleveland's had a pretty decent run defense this season. A lot of other things have gone wrong, but run defense has been pretty good for them overall. And last thing, Gary, this was another creamsicle fest. They let the Bengals wear their orange jerseys against the Browns. I don't know why the league doesn't make them wear the orange in another game. I hate it, because you get on that all-22, and there's a lot of orange and white just blending together. Bengals, I wish it to heck they wear their black jerseys when the Browns come into town. It drives me nuts.
Otherwise, everyone would watch this all-22 film of the Bengals' 30-16 victory over the Browns at home. Browns are running out of time, by the way, to get that win.
Yeah. Well, last year they got in week, 16 against San Diego?
I think you're right. It was snowy. It was December. Yeah. Let's just say week 16.
Any team, I'm sure no team in the history of the NFL has lost their first 15 games of the season back-to-back years. They've got to be... They're approaching some kind of awful record territory, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yep. And you know what I forgot to do, Andy? Look up the kicker/punter that we looked up last week, that we talked about last week for the Falcons.
I don't even remember what you're talking about now.
We talked about
doing the awards, though, or is this
awards
Falcons
kicker/punter. It is awards time.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The guy
and
that
by the way,
both.
I did. Before we move on to the awards, just real quick, got a tweet from this is Loftor Chris Jansson, and I'm sorry if I just butchered your name, but we had mentioned last week the Ravens with three shutouts this year. When's the last time someone had three shutouts? 76 Steelers, five shutouts, including three in a row at one point. So there's your answer to that, and we will continue to try and find out the name of that Falcons kicker slash punter, which would take like 12 seconds if we wanted to Google it right now, but we won't. We'll leave it hanging out there. It'll be a mystery, and I hope you enjoy the drama for at least one more week. When will we answer that question? I don't know.
Number 10.
Weekly awards. Offensive player of the week. Who do you have?
I was going to go Le'Veon Bell. I have to go Antonio Brown.
Okay, fair enough. I'm actually going to give it to Kamara in the losing effort just because it was not only a huge statistical day and kept him in the game, but it was just incredibly entertaining. Defensive player of the week.
Defensive player of the week. You know, Buffalo's entire defense showed up, and well, I'm not just going to give it to the whole defense, I guess, but I like the way their safeties have played all season long. Mm-hmm. Micah Hyde, who I felt bad leaving off my midseason All-Pro team, but I had to put Kevin Byard from the Titans on there. Byard does a little bit more. He's a more diverse player, but Hyde has had a great season. Jordan Poyer's played well. Those guys had another good game today.
I'm giving it to Tyrann Mathieu, who I thought looked as Tyrann Mathieu-ish as I can remember him looking in the last year and a half here. Really used him all over the place. A lot of blitzing, made a couple of big plays in the pass game, including the interception that sort of took back the ball when it looked like the Jaguars might go down and get the game-winning field goal in that one. So nice save for him. Special teams player of the week. Who do you have, Andy?
Specialty again. By the way, edge blitzing has become a big deal for Arizona the last few weeks, and it's a good rundown tactic to do. So against a team like Jacksonville, that works out well, and they've got two guys that can do it now, Mathieu and Buda Baker, who is very similar to Mathieu stylistically.
Yeah. Yep.
In fact, I'm going to make for my special teams, I assume he covered a kick or something, I'm going to make Buda Baker my special teams player of the week.
All right, there you go.
Did he play? He probably played, all right? I would think he played. Some kind, maybe he was on a kick field goal unit or something. I don't know.
That is enough to earn him the award. I will give it to Kalen Clay for the long. I mean, we already mentioned Phil Dawson on the show, but Kalen Clay had the long punt return, 60-yard punt return in the Panthers Jets game that sort of sealed that one away for the Panthers in a game that they sort of stole in East Rutherford. And also as I mentioned to her, Kaylin Kaler, our editorial assistant at the MMQB. She is still the number one Kalen out there, but Kalen Clay made up some ground with his performance.
All right.
Coach of the week, who do you have, Andy?
I have Sean McDermott going on the road at Kansas City, getting a win, getting his team back on track. And what I've noticed, and I noticed it again in this game today, and you actually see it on film quite a bit, no coach in the NFL runs along the sideline to try to help the officials spot the ball more consistently and aggressively than McDermott. He is always running around saying, pointing right here, fellas, right? That's where it was. And it tends to be a pretty favorable spot for Buffalo every time, I've noticed, too. The last little bit on McDermott along the lines of sideline McDermott, he's the only guy I know who has a name for the little hash marks that go along the sideline of the field. You know, they've got the hash marks in the middle of the field, but then the yard markings on the sideline. You know what he calls it? That area of the field? The zipper. The zipper of the field.
That's awesome. That's perfect.
Yeah, it is. I love it.
Did he come up with that? Do you know?
I know that James Urban, the Bengals receivers coach who knew McDermott when they were together on Andy Reid's staff actually in Philadelphia, he told me that's where he learned it from McDermott. So Urban calls it the zipper. I asked Rob Boris, their tight ends coach in Buffalo, says over the offseason if he's heard of the zipper. He hadn't heard the term before. I told him he would here soon. But, you know, that matter. Coaches, they've got a name for all these areas of the field because they have to tell the players where to run. And if you name those hash marks because at certain coverages, rarely do you tell your receiver to get outside onto the zipper of the field because you don't want to run your route into the sideline. But at certain times in some of the releases against cover two, where you're just trying to lift the safety, you do want to get outside and get onto the zipper. So it does become a coaching point. And I'm sure that's why James Urban remembers the name of it.
That is awesome and informative, and that's what we do around here. My coach of the week, I mean, there were so many good options this week, but I thought clearly the award belongs to Mark Trestman, Toronto Argos, reigning Anastukas Trophy Award winner.
Did he win something in Canada again?
Yeah, this is where we transition to me talking about the Grey Cup for 45 minutes and you say
oh,
nothing.
Oh, yeah, no, we're not going to do that. I met Mark Trestman once. I went up to his hotel suite. We were going to meet and talk football. This and all. And I mean, it's the combine. It was a meeting.
Okay.
A formal meeting. Thank you. Yeah.
No, I'm not even in that way. Just like you showed up at his hotel one day.
He invited me to come by. I think the time of the meeting was 5 a.m., if I recall.
Oh.
I almost thought, like, in the back of my mind, I thought maybe he doesn't want to meet. He's just, like, testing, like, to see if I'll say no or something. But, I showed up. We talked American football, not Canadian football, but he's obviously had a lot of success. And I guess you're telling me that he did something really well over there. Oh, we're going to talk for 45 minutes on Canada, you said.
Yeah, so he won the Anastukas Trophy earlier this season, but they were pretty heavy underdogs to Calgary in the Grey Cup. I wrote in my column this morning, I thought Calgary -7 was an absolute lock, and I recommended people mortgage their houses and put as much money as possible on that. And the Argos, Trestman's Argos, end up pulling it out in a game where they scored. You remember... Devere Posey, the Texans receiver?
Vaguely. Yeah, I remember the name. Yeah, vaguely.
He was Grey Cup MVP. He had a 100-yard touchdown catch. And they ended up getting, it looked like the Stampeders were going to put the game away late in the fourth quarter. Stampeders were up 8, driving for what would have been the ceiling touchdown in or maybe a rouge to sort of put this one away. They're up 24-16 with 4-something to go and ended up fumbling at the 1 yard line. It was a 109-yard fumble return by Cassius Vaughn to
I remember him.
Yeah,
he was a player for the Colts for a lot of years, wasn't he? Or not a lot of years, I'm sure, but I think he was a Colt.
He was one of those you know, I'll look it up for sure. He was a Charger. Yeah, he was a Colt for 2 years.
Yeah.
He was a Raven.
I've heard. Oh, wait,
he was
are
a
you
tie
still
cat.
Finishing? All right. Are you still finishing the story of this incredible ending, or are we done? Because I got a little tidbit on Trestman as well for Grey Cup or Canada football or whatever.
Yeah, I want to hear more about Trestman. Anyways, the Argos won. They kicked the field goal late to win 27-24. It was just absurd that they covered, let alone won.
All right. Somebody made a lot of money today who read your column, I'm sure.
No, they lost a lot of money.
Oh, they lost a lot of money. That's right. You lost someone's home. A lot of people lost their homes in this column. That's
they
what
did.
It was. I've heard, I think it was Trestman. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that one of the things he did that made him successful when he went over to Canada, he knew how to play with 11 guys because he'd been in the NFL. And they're used to 12 guys over there. So what he would do is just take one of his guys and line him up way outside the play, near the sideline.
On the zipper.
And it would make it 11-on-11 football, where he then had the tactical advantage because he was used to that. He knew the concepts. The Canadian coaches hadn't done that as much. I think that was him that did that. I could be totally wrong. But anyway, there are people in the NFL that say if I ever get sent off to Canada to coach, I'm just going to do that. I'm just going to make it 11-on-11 football anyway.
That's actually pretty good.
Smart, I guess.
It is.
I mean, it's your only. It'd be my only option if I went over there.
It's like basketball where you tell your guy you can't play, just always be in the opposite corner. Just stand the opposite corner no matter what's going on.
Yeah.
Seems to be against the spirit of 12-on-12. But yeah. All right, that's a wrap. That's our Grey Cup recap. And that, therefore, ends this show for Week 12. Thanks, as always, to producer Shelby Royston, also Lou Pellegrino, and editor Chris Basil. The guys at Cadence 13 always make us sound good. Also, thanks to Pro Flowers for helping us out. Please support them the way they support us. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a show. They wouldn't let us do it. So most of all, thank you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast all the way till the Grey Cup ending. You guys really are the best. Please keep on answering whatever unanswered questions we leave in the podcast, and then we will wrap it up. It'll be it's how you serialize the whole thing. We're both on Twitter, Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI. You can get us on Facebook, also talkback@themqb.com. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archive episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this show, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to your podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.